Historically, when we talk about scaling, an organization's impact, we always kind of fall back on this one term, you know, the one force multiplication.
Oh, yeah, standard corporate speak.
Right. You give a human a better tool, say, I don't know, a tractor instead of a hand shovel, or a massive automated spreadsheet instead of a physical paper ledger, and you measure the output in human hours.
Yeah, because the tool obviously doesn't just do the work on its own, it just makes the human using it dramatically faster.
Exactly. But the human is still the absolute bottleneck in that process. You're simply trying to push more productivity through the exact same narrow pipe of human attention.
Which eventually hits a hard limit. I mean, a person can only click so many buttons or read so many cells in a spreadsheet,
It's
right?
100%. But today, for you listening, we are taking a deep dive into a document that completely shatters that linear model of thinking. It's this highly technical, honestly staggering white paper from the Department of War.
Yeah, the Agent Control Plane Reference Architecture.
Right, the ACPRA for short. And early in this document, the author frames this entire shift we're seeing. They argue that we are moving away from force multiplication entirely and entering an era of what they call force creation.
Force creation, it's such a heavy phrase.
It really is. We are talking about scaling not by, you know, staffing up with thousands of more humans, but through generating agent hours via silicon. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're thrilled you could join us today because our mission is to explore how massive organizations are actively preparing to govern, control, and supervise autonomous AI.
Specifically, when it stops just chatting with us and starts actually doing things in the real world.
Yes, that distinction between chatting and doing is exactly why this source material matters so much to you. It's really easy to look at the title and think, well, this is a military document focused on adversarial environments and contested operations. Like, what does that have to do with me?
Right, you think it's just for generals in a bunker?
Exactly. But the framework it lays out, giving an AI a concrete identity, drawing strict boundaries around its actions, assigning it budgets, that is literally the blueprint for how every major enterprise, global bank, and tech company is going to handle AI in the very near future.
Oh, absolutely. The problems this architecture solves are universal. It doesn't matter if you're deploying troops or deploying marketing software. If the AI goes rogue, you have a massive problem.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can talk about controlling entire swarms of AI, the source makes it unequivocally clear that we have to fundamentally change our mental model of what AI software actually is.
Yeah, we have to stop treating it like a really smart calculator.
Or a glorified word processor. We have to start treating it like an independent actor.
And that mental pivot is the core of their very first architectural principle. They state that agents are non-person entities, or NPEs.
NPEs, right.
Because, think about it, we are so conditioned to think of AI as just an app. You open the window, you type a prompt, you get an answer, you close the window.
And the app goes to sleep.
Exactly, it's gone. But in this reference architecture, an agent is treated almost exactly like a human employee on a corporate network. It requires an explicit permanent identity.
Wait, like an actual employee ID?
Basically, yeah.
That.
It holds its own cryptographic credentials. It has lifecycle controls, and this is wild. It has an explicit binding to a human owner or sponsor who is ultimately accountable for whatever it does.
So somebody's job is actually on the line for this NPE.
Oh, absolutely. And most crucially, it operates under what the architecture calls a trust scope manifest or a
A
TSM.
trust scope manifest. Okay, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. Initially, I thought of this like giving the AI a corporate ID badge and running a background check, you know, could get you into the building.
Sure, that makes sense on the surface.
But an ID badge just opens doors, right? It doesn't stop you from doing something incredibly reckless once you're inside the room.
Yeah.
So it's less like downloading Microsoft Word and more like hiring a new contractor.
Right.
They need the ID badge, the background check, and an explicit list of rooms they're allowed to enter. Actually, it's really more like handing the AI a smart corporate credit card, right?
That is a much more accurate way to look at it. Yeah.
Like one that physically melts if you try to buy something that isn't on the pre-approved list and just immediately cuts off your funding if you spend too much time in one store.
Exactly. The TSM is a strict versioned cryptographic contract. It literally travels with the agent wherever it goes.
Wow.
It defines exactly what this specific AI is allowed to do in real time. It outlines the approved tools it can touch, the specific environment it can operate in, and it enforces strict budgets.
And we aren't just talking about financial budgets, right?
No. Computational limits, token usage limits, time limits. If it exceeds those, It's frozen.
Okay, but let me push back on the fundamental premise here.
Go for it.
If an AI is, at its core, just a really advanced statistics engine generating text based on a prompt, I mean, it's just guessing the next word in a sequence, why on earth does a math engine need a literal corporate identity in a cryptographic contract?
What's fascinating here is how the architecture solves that exact dilemma by separating data sources from authority sources.
Data versus authority.
Exactly. This is a massive paradigm shift for system design. Mm-hmm. Think about older, sloppier systems. If you typed a prompt saying, delete the main database, the system might actually try to execute that command just because the text was generated by the user.
Because the system assumes if you typed it, you meant it, and it should do it.
Yeah.
The text itself triggered the action.
Right. But this reference architecture explicitly states that a prompt never grants authority.
Because the prompt is just data. It's literally just a string of characters.
Yes. Prompts, retrieved documents, tool outputs, they're all treated purely as information. They inform the AI's decisions, but they never, ever grant privileges.
So they can suggest what to do, but they can't authorize it.
Right. The document notes that an agent's declared intent, like, say, generating the code to delete a database, is just a claim. It's just the AI saying, hey, I'd like to do this.
But the actual physical authorization to execute that command comes exclusively from that signed trust scope and the authenticated identity of the agent.
Exactly. The AI can hallucinate and generate all the text it wants about shutting down a server, but unless its NPE identity and its trust scope explicitly authorize that specific action in that specific environment, the system physically will not allow the command to pass.
Which perfectly leads into the mechanism of how they actually stop that from happening.
Right, the boundaries.
Yeah. We've given this AI a smart card, we've locked down its identity, but how do we prevent it from accidentally or, you know, maliciously walking into the digital server room and yanking out the power cord?
The authors introduced the concept of the doing boundary, and they put it very bluntly in the text. I love this quote. It can think is not the same as it can do.
That's a great line. It can think is not the same as it can do.
Right. And the architecture enforces this boundary through components they call bulkhead gateways.
Bulkhead, like on a submarine.
Exactly like a submarine. There is zero direct connection between the AI model thinking about a problem and the tool that executes the solution. Every single action is mediated through a bulkhead.
And to manage this practically, they categorize every potential action into consequence tiers.
Yes. Tiers 0 through 3.
Okay. Rather than just listing those tiers like a textbook, let's actually play out some scenarios for you, the listener, to see how the bulkhead gateways handle different levels of risk.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let's do it.
Let's start with tier 0. This is the lowest consequence. Say I ask the AI to summarize a massive logistics report and draft an email.
Okay, so the bulkhead looks at the trust scope, sees that drafting and read-only analysis are tier 0 actions. It poses virtually zero operational risk. So the gateway just lets the action pass seamlessly. The AI drafts the email.
Okay, simple enough. Now let's escalate to tier 1, moderate consequence. I want the AI to propose a change to the company's software code. It's essentially drawing up a blueprint for a new bridge, but it's not pouring the concrete yet.
Right. This is where things like automating a support ticket or creating a pull request for code live. The bulkhead recognizes this as tier 1. It allows the AI to create the draft or the proposal, but the action stops short of finalizing the change.
So the blueprint is filed. But the system actively prevents the AI from unilaterally building it.
Precisely. A human still has to click merge.
Okay. Tier 2, high consequence. The AI wants to take that blueprint and actually change the live production servers or, say, alter user permissions.
Okay, here. The bulkhead hits the brakes hard. Tier 2 mandates a human on the loop.
Human on the loop, meaning the AI can't do it alone.
Right. The AI can do all the prep work. It can queue up the precise execution commands. But the bulkhead physically halts the process right there and pings an authorized human. The action requires explicit cryptographic human approval to actually fire.
Wow. And there's tier 3. The source refers to this as kinetic adjacent effects.
Yeah, that's where things get really serious.
For those outside the military or industrial space, kinetic adjacent basically means actions that cause real physical movement or catastrophic changes in the real world. Think about, like, redirecting a physical supply drone or opening a pressure valve on a literal oil pipeline.
Yeah, for tier 3, the default posture is a strict hard deny. Just deny by default. An agent cannot execute a tier 3 action without quorum approvals, intense scrutiny, and multiple layers of human authorization.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The document lists a very specific category of tools that fall under heavy scrutiny, regardless of the tier. They call them computer use or GUI actuation tool.
Oh, yeah. The mouse and keyboard stuff.
Right. We're talking about an AI using a virtual mouse and keyboard to click around a desktop, just like a human would. I mean, we see tech demos of this on social media all the time, and we think, wow, it's the future of productivity. The AI is doing my accounting.
Yeah, people love those demos.
But the Department of War looks at an AI using a mouse and sees a terrifying, fragile vulnerability.
Because they treat it as inherently high risk. Graphical interfaces just weren't built for machines. They were built for human eyes.
Exactly.
If a website button moves, say, 3 pixels to the left after an update, a human adjusts effortlessly without even noticing. But an AI using a mouse based on screen coordinates, it might accidentally click delete instead of save.
Which is terrifying when you're talking about enterprise data.
Exactly. The architecture recognizes that giving an AI these kinds of tools expands its capabilities, but simultaneously explodes its attack surface.
So if an agent absolutely has to use a graphical interface, the rules are incredibly strict. It gets put into an isolated desktop sandbox.
A literal sandbox, yeah.
And it operates on what they call step budgets. It's only allowed a highly specific number of clicks or keystrokes before the system forcibly cuts it off.
Right. It can't just endlessly click around hoping to eventually find the right menu.
That paranoia totally extends to how they view tools in general. The ACPRA treats tools and skills not as, you know, fun little plugins you download from an app store, but as a heavily governed supply chain.
They use provenance tiers for everything. Mm. Tier A tools are first-party, fully tested, securely owned tools.
The gold standard.
Tier B are vetted third-party tools that have been deeply scanned by security teams. And Tier C are untrusted, community-built tools, which are just denied by default.
So you cannot just plug a random internet search tool you found on GitHub into your high-tier logistics agent.
Absolutely not. Every single tool is treated as a potential vector for a massive system compromise.
Okay, so we've established the foundation here. We have non-person entities with smart contracts. They're operating behind bulkheads, and they're using a strictly governed supply chain of tools.
Yep, that's the baseline.
But let's look at the reality of the modern workplace. If an AI can execute long-running, really complex tasks across dozens of these tools in parallel, how does a human actually supervise it?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. Because if I have to manually review every single subtask and approve every single database query, I've just become a massive bottleneck. We've lost the entire force creation advantage and gone right back to measuring human hours.
The architecture anticipates that exact bottleneck. And to solve it, they introduced this brilliant concept called the work unit.
The work unit.
Yes. This is the core unit of supervision. The human operator does not sit there and watch every single tool call, and they certainly don't read every single prompt generated by the agent. They supervise the bounding box of the work unit itself.
Okay, so think of it like watching a massive multi-day sports tournament with dozens of games happening simultaneously.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Yeah. You don't sit in the stands and watch every single pass or every single play in every single game. You'd lose your mind.
You literally couldn't do it.
Instead, you look at the master scoreboard that's your work unit dashboard. You monitor the overall progress, the budget of time remaining, the score differentials, and you only watch the replay highlights when a referee throws a flag on the field.
That is perfectly put. And the architecture supports exactly that kind of replay mechanism through something called the evidence ledger.
The evidence ledger. How does that work?
Well, every time an agent takes an action, it creates an action envelope. And this isn't just a simple text log file that can be easily edited or, you know, deleted by a hacker. This envelope contains cryptographically secure hashes, specifically an envelope hash and an evidence root hash.
And a hash being basically a unique digital fingerprint of the data. Like, if even one character in the log is changed, the fingerprint shatters, and you know instantly that the record was tampered with.
Exactly. And because every single action is hashed and cryptographically linked to the previous action, it creates an unbroken chain of custody for both the AI's thought and its action. It forms a completely verifiable lineage graph.
So that allows for continuous authorization.
Yes. If a flag is thrown on the field, going back to your sports analogy, if the agent tries to exceed its budget or touch a restricted file, the operator doesn't have to guess what happened.
They just check the replay.
Right. They can perform what the paper calls macro, meso, or micro replays. You can trace a specific failure all the way back to the exact version of the model that made the decision, the specific context documents it read to justify that decision, and the exact version of the policy bundle that permitted it to happen.
You essentially have mathematical proof of the AI's entire operational logic.
Yes, mathematical proof. It's bulletproof auditing.
So we have total visibility and control over a single agent. But the document obviously doesn't stop there. A single agent can't run a global supply chain or coordinate a massive military operation. It has to talk to other agents.
Right. We are moving into the realm of multi-agent governance or swarms.
Swarms. And let me ask you, doesn't giving these highly restricted lockdown entities the ability to conspire and communicate with each other just immediately break all the safety rules we just set up?
Oh, the authors are incredibly blunt about that exact danger. Multi-agent behavior is where operational risk truly amplifies.
It has to, right?
Yeah. If you let agents communicate without strict governance, you get catastrophic emergent behaviors. One really common failure is cascading retries.
What does that look like?
Say Agent A needs data from Agent B, but Agent B crashes. Agent A might just relentlessly spam Agent B with requests until the entire network is congested and the whole thing fails.
Oh, wow. Like a self-inflicted denial of service attack.
Exactly. Or you get deadlocks, where both agents are just sitting there waiting for the other to move first forever. But the most dangerous risk they identify, by far, is collective hallucination.
Okay, let's illustrate that for the listener. Say one agent is analyzing a satellite image and mistakenly concludes that a critical server facility is located in London when it's actually in Berlin.
Okay.
It writes that false conclusion into the swarm's shared memory. Suddenly, 50 other agents read that shared memory. They don't verify the image themselves, right? They just treat the London location as a hard fact.
Right, because it's in the shared memory.
So they start routing logistics, scheduling maintenance, alerting personnel, all based on a complete fabrication. The shared memory reinforces the hallucination until it literally becomes the swarm's operational reality.
It's terrifying. And to prevent that kind of cascading disaster, the ACPRA mandates ensemble contract.
Fizz on contract.
Yeah. Whenever a swarm is formed to tackle a problem, it must be bound by a contract that defines its specific coordination pattern. Like, is it a hierarchical swarm where one boss agent dictates tasks and acts as the single source of truth? Or is it peer-to-peer, requiring consensus before acting?
So it sets the rules of engagement for the bots.
Exactly. The contract defines the budgets for the entire swarm collectively, and most importantly, it establishes conflict arbitration rules.
Mm-hmm.
When two agents inevitably disagree on a fact, like the London versus Berlin server, the contract dictates exactly how that dispute is resolved without hallucinating.
But practically speaking, what happens when things go wrong? Let's say you have a swarm of 50 agents working on a massive problem, and just one of those agents gets compromised by bad data and goes completely rogue.
Okay.
Don't you have to shut the entire 50-agent swarm down just to be safe? Doesn't that make swarms incredibly fragile?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how massive systems survive, the authors totally anticipated that exact fragility. They outline a defensive principle called containment without collapse.
Containment without collapse. I like the sound of that.
The system is engineered to quarantine a single misbehaving agent, literally severing its access to tools and isolating its communications without destroying the progress of the entire ensemble.
Ah, okay. So it's like putting one aggressively misbehaving player into the penalty box rather than canceling the entire tournament.
That's a great way to picture it. And if the situation deteriorates even further, the system has the ability to freeze the coordination of the swarm entirely.
It just stops them all.
Yeah. It pauses all messaging, preserves the exact state of the work unit, and just waits for a human to review the evidence ledger. It doesn't wipe the slate clean and force you to start over. It hits a very secure, cryptographically backed pause button. It isolates the failure while preserving the mission.
But all of this sophisticated governance, it assumes that the underlying system itself is stable, right?
It does.
Swarms rely on high-speed networks, massive cloud servers, constant API connections. What happens when the world goes sideways? When the network is jammed, the cloud is physically disconnected, or the models themselves are under a targeted cyber attack?
That brings us to one of the most critical and frankly realistic sections of the white paper, adversarial robustness and contested or degraded operation.
Because things will break.
Exactly. Remember, this architecture assumes from day one that the operating environment will be inherently hostile. In traditional corporate IT, an unexpected outage is a massive emergency. Alarms go off, the system crashes, and all work just stops. But in the ACPRA, degraded operation is not a surprise. It is a declared policy mode.
meaning the system is actually trained on how to fail gracefully.
Exactly. If an agent loses its connection to the main policy engine in headquarters, or it gets cut off from the massive primary commercial AI model running in the cloud, it doesn't just throw an error code and die.
It keeps going.
It seamlessly shifts into predefined operational modes, like denied model or intermittent connectivity modes.
So what does that actually mean for the agent trying to do its job in the dark?
Well, it falls back to smaller, locally hosted models that don't require an internet connection. And because those local models are, you know, less capable and more prone to error, the agent automatically tightens its own operational budgets.
Well, that's smart.
Yeah. It restricts its tool access to read only. It is fully aware that it is operating in a degraded state, so it autonomously throttles its own authority until full connectivity is restored.
So if the agents are autonomously managing their own degraded states, when does the system actually throw up its hands and say, all right, I need a human right now?
The paper defines a very precise escalation taxonomy. It lists the exact triggers that will force an agent to pause and demand human intervention.
Let's look at how those triggers work in practice. There are four of them, right?
Yep. Four main triggers. The first is confidence. If the agent's internal calibration shows high uncertainty, maybe it's getting conflicting data from two different sensors, it stops. It doesn't guess.
Okay, that makes sense. The second trigger is novelty.
Right.
Let's say the AI is trying to query an API it uses every single day, but the API has been updated and is suddenly returning error codes in French instead of English.
Hmm.
The agent has never seen this before.
So its internal calibration trips the novelty wire, halts the action, and escalates to a human, rather than trying to blindly guess what the French error code means.
Got it. And the third trigger is consequence.
Yes. As we discussed with the tiers earlier, any action that is irreversible or physically impactful automatically triggers a human. No exceptions.
And finally, behavioral anomalies.
Yeah, this one is crucial. The system constantly monitors the agent's baseline behavior. If it detects a drift signal, say, an agent that normally sends 3 database queries a minute suddenly tries to send $3,000, it flags a human immediately, suspecting a compromise or a logic loop.
It's an incredibly comprehensive, layered safety net. Okay, let's take a step back and synthesize the journey we've been on today for you, the listener.
It's been a lot of ground to cover.
It really has. We started by discarding the outdated idea of AI as a simple chatbot. We moved to understanding it as a governed, accountable, non-person entity carrying a cryptographic smart contract.
Yep, the NPEs and the TSMs.
We explored how its actions are walled off by bulkhead gateways, preventing it from executing dangerous commands just because it thought of them. We saw how its tasks are supervised at scale through bounded work units and a mathematically verifiable evidence ledger.
And we explored how these agents can operate in massive coordinated swarms, gracefully degrading their capabilities when the network goes dark rather than just crashing. This raises an important question, though, for anyone looking at the future of their own industry.
What's that?
Well, everything we've discussed today, the local models, the infrastructure, the networking, the underlying technology to create these autonomous swarms, largely exists right now. It's not science fiction.
Right. The pieces are already on the board.
Exactly. But the real bottleneck going forward, the factor that will determine which organizations actually succeed in this new era, isn't just raw compute power or, you know, having the smartest model. It's governance.
Governance.
Yes. Organizations will only be able to move as fast as their ability to safely audit, supervise, and, when necessary, roll back these agents. Without a rigorous control plane like the one outlined here, speed just creates unmanageable, catastrophic risk.
It's not about how fast the engine can push the car. It's about how reliable the brakes are.
That's exactly it.
And before we go, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over. Buried in the appendices of this architecture document is a fascinating note about how agents will share different types of memory within a swarm.
Oh, this part is wild.
It really is. Specifically, yeah. They talk about procedural memory and episodic memory. Procedural memory is the logic of how to do a task, how to route a shipment, how to balance a ledger. Episodic memory is the history of what actually happened, the specific shipments that were delayed last Tuesday, the specific errors encountered. If we have swarms of AI dynamically sharing these memories, learning from each other's mistakes, and updating their own operational policies in real time across an entire global enterprise,
At
what point does a company's most valuable asset cease to be its human talent and instead become the shared collective memory of its AI swarm?
Wow.
We started today talking about force creation replacing force multiplication. When the silicon remember the history of the company better than the staff, that creation takes on a life of its own. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparks some new ideas for you, and we warmly invite you to keep learning, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.